Hi, everyone. I'm Lula.
And I'm Jude.
And welcome back to Just
This one's crazy. This
Friends.
one's
Okay,
crazy.
authentic cheering.
Yeah.
Today we are doing our final guest episode of season three.
Yeah.
I think, Jude, you should go straight into intro.
All right, I'll do the intro. Today, I have the honor to introduce the final guest of season three and probably the most influential professor I've ever had at Yale. She's responsible for my gratitude journaling, my meditation practice, and me not knowing any of my Yale grades since freshman fall.
Crazy.
Dr. Lori Santos is the professor of the most popular class ever taught at Yale, Psychology and the Good Life, and was the head of Silliman College. She's the host of the Happiness Lab podcast and has been featured in the New York Times, GQ, Time Magazine, and so many more publications. I forgot the word. Professor Santos, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to Just Friends.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
It's pretty
Yay.
wild.
I
Lori,
know, my heart's beating.
you didn't know, because like it's a big class. It's like 500 kids, right? Okay, so
And
like,
that was just your year. The year before it was 1200. So the first time I taught it. So yeah, really incredible class.
1200.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's like, isn't that like a quarter of Yale practically?
It's a quarter of the Yale campus. Yeah. We had to
Wow.
teach it in Woolsey Hall. It was so huge. So
Whoa.
crazy. That's a special place though to teach class.
That is a cool place. Is that
Yeah,
the
it was
only
pretty
class
fun. It
that's
was pretty
ever been
fun.
taught in Woolsey Hall?
To my knowledge, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we get into like the class itself, which I think is like the core meat that we're excited to talk about, we just love to hear like a little bit of your life story. Like you went to Harvard, right?
Yeah, I went to that other school over in Cambridge.
Ooh.
But really similar, right? So I think I really kind of got a sense of what, life in a residential college or a house, as they call it there, is like, right? I mean, I think a lot of the pressures that everyone faces at Yale were the similar kinds of things I experienced at Harvard. But I went there in the late 90s, right? And I think a lot of those pressures were totally different back then.
How are they different?
I think people were kind of stressed about getting into college, but then there was a sense that once you got in, you were good, right? If you got into a place like Harvard or Yale, like that was it, right? This was kind of right before the dot-com boom. I think there wasn't as many economic anxieties. I just think like we worked hard to get into college, but then when we got to college, it was like, whew, okay, now I can just like study what I want and like focus on things that kind of give me purpose and excitement and just sort of trying to engage in whatever ways you wanted to. I don't think there was this pressure of, the next step, right? And I think the problem with the current generation is like that carrot that's dangling just out of reach. Like even when you grab it and you get into an Ivy League school or you kind of get to the next amazing step, it doesn't like it's yours and you're done. It's like the next hurdle is set up and the next hurdle and the next hurdle. So it never really seems to stop in the way that it kind of did feel like it stopped back in my generation.
I think that like there is a real expectation of like, oh, like once you're in, like I had this. I was like, oh my God, like once I get into Yale, like I'm so good. Like I got into Yale, like that was so exciting. And then I get here and we talk about this all the time. And we also had like Professor Derezowitz, who wrote Excellent Sheep on the podcast. And like it is a treadmill. Like you keep going. And I think that like no matter what college you're at, I think that is the general vibe on Yale campus or not on college campuses in the 21st century, which is sad. It is sad because it does kind of ring out this like opportunity to explore and figure out what you want to do with your life. It's like, oh wait, no, like there's no time to explore. You got to like keep going.
Yeah.
And I think it really puts pressure on to figure things out, not just at the college level of like, oh, there's no time to explore and keep going. I think that pressure starts earlier and earlier. Like, I watch my friends' age parents with kids who are saying like, oh, my toddler's really interested in, I don't know, math. Like maybe they're going to do AI or CS or like, it's like you get kind of career focused super early on, way, way before, my generation did. And I think that's a problem because, there's so much evidence suggesting that, well, first of all, like you don't necessarily know what you want to do. Like none of you and no, nobody your age has any idea, right? And that in some ways it's good that you don't have any idea because like, let's say someone my age had an idea of what they wanted to do. So many careers would be not possible, right? Like I couldn't have known that I would love being a podcaster because there was no such thing as a podcast. There was no such thing as Facebook. There was no such thing as the internet, right? So I guess it's like, what kind of new developments are going to happen when your generation is in their 40s, right? Like you couldn't be planning what career you want to do now because hopefully there's just going to be so many different opportunities that you couldn't have even known back then. And so in some ways, it's like, just philosophically impossible for you to know what you want to do just because the options are going to be completely different when you all are my age.
How did you figure out like psychology and happiness was kind of the like route you wanted to go? Like,
Yeah, well,
what was that exploration phase like?
Yeah, well, the psychology part was like much, much earlier than the happiness part, honestly. I kind of knew I might want to major in psychology at the when I first started at Harvard. I was really thinking that I wanted to go into law. Somehow I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. And I think that was kind of a little bit how I grew up. Like, you know, in my high school, if you went to college, you were either like a doctor or a lawyer, maybe a teacher. And I knew I didn't want to be a doctor because I'm like blood and guts were kind of meh. And so I was like, okay, lawyer, like kind of by default, that's what like smart people who go to college do. And then I didn't my freshman year get into the kind of course that many pre-law students get into at Harvard. It was kind of the equivalent of the sort of con law class that Akhil Amar teaches at Yale, but I kind of got lotteried out. And so I was like, oh, I don't know what to do. And at the time, my first year advisor suggested, well, why don't you try psych? You know, like lots of lawyers need psychology, you know, try that out. And I took the intro psych class and just really got hooked. Like I really loved it. And wound up early on meeting with my professor who mentioned, you know, hey, undergrads work in labs. Like if you need a job to work in lab, like you could try that out. And so, I mean, I was kind of clueless. It wasn't like I was trying to get a job in a lab. I was like, oh, you know, I need a job on campus. Like, let me try that out. And so that meant that like really early on in my first year at Harvard, I wind up like engaging in psychological research. At the time I was doing research in kind of cognitive neuroscience and sort of mental imagery. But like, I just really loved it. This idea that like there are these puzzles about the mind and we could do research to figure it out. It also helped that I had really great like PhD students at the time who were really good mentors for me. And so I felt like I kind of had some belonging. I get taken into this sort of lab community and it was just really fun. And so since then, I kind of knew that I wanted to do something in the field of psychology.
And then what brought you to the happiness focus?
Well, the happiness stuff, as I mentioned, happened much later. It happened really when I started as a head of college at Silliman. And at that point, I'd already been teaching at Yale for, you know, around 15 years. So like I'd seen undergraduate life. I'd seen kind of life, what like things were like. But I think I didn't really know what student mental health was like till I was sort of in the trenches as head of Silliman, you know, and I was seeing, you know, the things that you know are true, which is like, there are just lots of people in our community who are experiencing suicidality or just facing like really severe depression or anxiety and just so many students who, even if they're not at that level, are just like stressed out to the brink, like just like really kind of feeling like they're burned out, right? And honestly, I wasn't really expecting to see that. And so the transition to the happiness stuff was really thinking about like the fact that our field isn't doing that much for students, right? Like we know a lot about practices that can reduce burnout, that can reduce stress, that can make you feel better. And I felt like the field and maybe at Yale in general, we weren't doing a great job of teaching students those strategies. And so I kind of retrained in that work in psychology in part because I really wanted to teach a class on that topic.
I'm really like interested in your experience being like kind of going from a professor. Sorry, first I'll do a preface question. When you were teaching before you became head of college, was it mostly lectures or seminar?
It was a lot lectures. I taught a class back in the day that had the nickname of Sexy Psych, which is a kind of human evolutionary psychology class. We think about how like human mating is similar to animals and things. And so I kind of was known for another big class back then. Yeah. But I also did a lot of like work one-on-one with students kind of in my lab. And so I taught seminars for students who worked in my comparative cognition lab. I spent a lot of my time at Yale studying animals. And so I did work really closely with college students. In fact, I would, you know, spend time at field sites with them and so on. But I think it was really when I was seeing the community en masse and kind of seeing students, I think, not in an academic setting, right? Like as a head of college, you run into students like in the dining hall, right? You're like heading through the buttery in the middle of the night and you see them dragging their laundry. It's like a more kind of vulnerable, intimate kind of experience you get with students. And I think it was there that I really saw the mental health crisis. I mean, I think another thing to say is that the college student mental health crisis has gotten much worse since I started. You know, the spike in things like depression and anxiety kind of happened around 2007, 2008, right? That's when you see the curves really going up. And I'd already been teaching for a couple of years at that point. And so I think it wasn't just that I wasn't seeing it, or I wasn't just in a position not to see it. It was also that the rates were going up, kind of skyrocketing as I took on this new role as a head of college.
Yeah. The reason I ask about the lecture seminars, because Jude and I'm a sociology major and Jude is cog sci. Mm-hmm. And so we have very different, just structurally, relationships with our professors and our classes. I'm in almost exclusively like 10 person or under seminars. And Jude is like, I could not walk up to my professors. And I think, So I just think it's so interesting, like thinking about the different experiences that like head of college can give you versus you're teaching a incredibly massive class. It's super interesting.
Just the fact that like you were one of the most influential teachers, probably the most influential teacher I've had. And like, we didn't really know each other until like this opportunity. And like, that's because like you can't, how would you ever meet 500 or 1200 kids, right? Like that's really hard. But
there,
like that
there
is
a strange phenomena where I feel like, especially when I was teaching the biggest version of that class, that 1200 person version, which happened in 2018, where I'd be walking around campus and I'd experience the thing that like famous people talk about experiencing, where it's like you're walking and somebody's looking at you and they have full recognition, like they know you really well, and you're like, I don't think I've ever seen you before, you know. But so it's very strange. It's a little surreal.
That brings us into like a real thing that we're like excited to discuss with you, which is like, so like you were named to Times Magazine leading campus celebrity, right? Like you, and like New York Times article like blew you up. Like you really went from like a professor here at Yale to like a celebrity, a micro celebrity that like a lot of people, you're a household name. When I tell people I go to Yale, people will ask me about the happiness class. And that's probably like a really strange transition. And
oh,
like,
totally
were
strange.
You expecting
super
it?
Strange. No, not at all. Like, like not at all, at all, at all. I think really the New York Times article was the tipping point. And it was actually a student who was at Yale at the time who wrote the article. It was the then kind of editor of the YDN who was getting a job at the New York Times after he graduated. He was a senior at the time when I taught my class. And they're kind of like, well, write about something that's happening on campus. That's kind of cool. And then his article went viral. It was one of the top 10 read articles of that entire year. And I think that just like generated, I mean, the story that everyone was interested in is that like, how could it possibly be the case that students at Yale need a class on happiness? I mean, I think everyone who's outside of Yale thinks like, all of you are so happy. Like you've made it in life, right? You got your dream school. You got into your dream school. Like you're 19, you have your whole life ahead of you with all these opportunities and privileges. How could you possibly be anything but just like optimistic and happy and grateful at every moment of your time at Yale? And I think that seeing that so many students were struggling was kind of a wake up call for people. And it really caused people to ask the question kind of what's happening on college campuses generally, you know, if this is happening at Yale, what's happening elsewhere? But also it caused people to say, wait a minute, if these folks with all this privilege, all these opportunities are feeling so stressed out, what can I do? Like I'm feeling stressed out too, and I don't even have this privilege and these opportunities. And so, so I think it just kind of struck a chord really in a way that I just absolutely didn't expect. It was a little surreal. After the New York Times article, pretty much every other class that first year in 2018, we had a major national or international news company in class filming. So I'd have to, like almost every other class, give out these forms of like, okay, if you sit in the first 20 rows of Woolsey, remember you're going to be on the Today Show or you're going to be on NBC News. Whoa. So like, it was really crazy. It was a little weird.
So we took the class in, what year is that? 2021?
Yeah.
Right? 2021 spring. So I'm just like curious about how the campus celebrity idea changed your teaching experience. Because I think obviously if there's any, I mean, with any celebrity ever, but also I think probably especially because of like the insularity of Yale, like there's so much just like everyone talks about it, whatever the thing is. Like there's so much positive, like everyone needs to take this class. There's a lot of like kind of critique on Twitter and like what these sort of like parody video. Yeah. Then Fizz became a thing, which was like, I was never on Fizz, but like quasi Twitter or something. I don't know. Just these platforms for everyone to say every single thing they're thinking. I'm just curious how that impacted your teaching in 2021.
Yeah. I mean, it was just sort of like interesting and surreal, right? Like it's really hard to just do the class when everyone, first of all, just has so many expectations about the class of like what's going to be in it and what's not going to be in it and so on. I think it also made it really hard to kind of keep up, right? Like it's one thing if I'm, you know, I'm in a small seminar, I'm getting feedback from 20 students about like, okay, what would you like to see? What would you like more of? Would you like less of? That's so much harder when there's 500 students, and especially when students are posting stuff on channels that I can't even see, you know? So it's like oftentimes students who I either knew from Silliman or in my lab would send me like screenshots of these things, you know, and then I could kind of react to them. But like, I'm not on Fizz. I'm not on these platforms to kind of see this stuff. Right. And so it made it kind of tricky, but yeah, so it was a little surreal. I think it's also worth noting that, you know, that was sort of a strange semester. I think you all started then, so you didn't realize how weird it was to be teaching like in a mask. You know, if you recall, our first 2 weeks of class were just me in an empty room, you know, sending things via Zoom, right?
Like, and drama blocked that.
Yeah, totally, right? And I think that also kind of had a kind of weird stamp on the class too, where, you know, it, literally for several weeks of the class, I didn't see any of my students because nobody was in the room. And so I think it was also just a strange time on campus. And yeah, so, but yeah, I wish there was more ways to kind of get to know students and to kind of have a more kind of like closer experience with the students who really want to engage than the kind of usual channels.
Mm-hmm. I have like a bit of like a pushing question that I'd love to hear your thought. So like Carl Jung has this concept that people often like choose professions where like an unconscious tendency to choose professions with things that they're still grappling with, and that they're things like, does that resonate with you when you think about happiness and well-being? And do you think that played a role in you choosing to teach a course like this?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, in academics, we joke that research is me search, right? In so many domains. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the main impetus for teaching a class was like seeing how much my Silliman community that I cared about so much when I was head of college was struggling and wanting to help them. But I think alongside that was this idea that like, all the things that students were going through, like I wasn't necessarily doing any better with, right? Mm-hmm. The things that I wanted to critique students for, to say, oh my gosh, like you're so stressed out, you're wasting all this precious time that you have at Yale. It was like, well, wait, I'm doing that too, right? You know, so I was both in my head kind of wishing students had a different attitude towards what was going on, wishing that they were doing things to protect their self-care and kind of deal with their stress. But then I was also watching myself like not do that either. And I remember kind of one very particular moment in the Silliman courtyard as I was kind of walking through the courtyard and ran into a student I knew really well. I was like, hey, how's it going? They were like, oh my God, if I could just fast forward through midterms. Like, oh my God, if I could just like get through the next 2 months, you know? And I had two immediate reactions that were really different. One was like, how can you say that? Like, you know, 2 months of your college career is like the whole thing. Like, how could you want to fast forward that? But then I was also thinking like, oh my gosh, yeah, me too. Like, if I could just fast, like, we just get to end of April, like we'd all be so much happier. And so I kind of was realizing that like I wasn't embodying the right strategies for my students either, right? Like I wasn't living a life where I was prioritizing social connection and not having my schedule chronically overwhelmed all the time and things like that. And so in a lot of ways, the class really was for me to find strategies for myself, not necessarily to be happier, but just to kind of be a better example, right? I think that's sort of the problem with a lot of Yale students is you also just don't have great positive role models for people who are engaging in care, but also performing at a really high level. I think we just don't see examples of what that looked like. And I was realizing that me not being an example as a head of college was problematic and that I should try to fix that too.
And I think obviously there's a level of it that's just like the institution itself, like makes it very, as we've all lived and talk about, like it's very hard to be to exist at a high performing level and also have balance when every single aspect of Yale seems incredibly demanding and impossible to sort of find any time for yourself. I don't know.
But I feel like in some ways, so I think I both agree with you and also think like, but then we've gotten really off track, right? You know, we started this conversation with the idea that like when I was in college in the 90s, it wasn't like it was a cakewalk. It wasn't like it was easy. But we had a lot of balance, right? Like I always had time to sleep. I always had time to connect with friends. Like, but I did okay. I mean, I graduated Ivy League and got to do all these things in my career. And so somehow we've like had this arms race of the kinds of things that are expected of students in a way that I don't think is increasing their learning or their performance. It's just kind of increasing, you know, as you had with Alan on before, like this kind of idea that we're like excellent sheep, right? That you're kind of, you know, ticking off all the boxes, but it's not clear how many of those boxes are actually relevant for you to like learn well or perform well or kind of get to the next level. And so, you know, one of the kind of critiques that came up in the class, and it's something that I've kind of tried to pursue more, is like, are we kind of doing wrong by our students at Ivy League universities by pushing them so hard to get in? right? You know, it's kind of a joke these days that, what is it, 3.7% of students who applied to Yale got in.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we just set up this, like, we were doing great and produced a lot of, you know, excellent, intelligent, you know, well-educated people when, you know, 12% of students got in. When I got into Harvard, the rate was around 10 or 12%, right? Which at the time we thought was like, whoa, it's so selective. It was the most selective university in the world. But like, it wasn't so ridiculous. You didn't have to have so many AP classes, so many extracurriculars. Like, no students were mortgaging their high school years to be able to get into a place like that. And so I think we really need to think about this arms race, right? And I think in some ways, like, it's not going to hurt anybody's performance to think about that arms race. Like, Yale will tell you that by any metric you look at, whether it's valedictorians or SAT scores or whatever, they could have had five times the number of students that hit that criteria, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this is why they were able to increase the college size to add Franklin and Murray so easily without destroying. It wasn't like, well, we got to take some of the worst students, you know, if we're going to have more students. No, like, the level of the student was exactly the same. And that's true at Harvard and Princeton and Stanford, MIT, you know, all the big schools. And I think what universities could do, especially if they did it kind of in conjunction with one another, would be to admit that. Imagine Yale said, all right, we're just going to set, you know, this kind of minimum standard that you need to get on your SAT or like maybe number of APs to get in. But after that, if you do more, fine, like, you know, good for you. But like, we don't care. We're not going to look at it. And Harvard, Princeton, you know, MIT, Stanford, all the rest of them do the same, right? Mm. What would that cause high school students to do? I think that would cause high school students to like, oh, take a breath. Or if you overloaded your schedule, hopefully it would be on the stuff that you didn't think was going to like impress some college because they're not looking at it. You just did it because you kind of were interested in it or you liked it, right? I think we wouldn't change anything about the quality of our student body if we switched to a model like that. I think if anything, we get a student body that was like mentally healthier, and everything we know about mental health suggests that you learn better and you perform better when you're experiencing more positive emotion, you have more life satisfaction, and so on. So I think ironically, reducing the kind of extreme standards we've gotten to for college admission at these Ivy League universities and the kind of super top universities, I think if we change those criteria around, we would actually get students who performed better, who learned better.
And I also imagine that people would have a better sense of themselves and what they're authentically passionate about if they have time to explore that. And
I mean, the fact that the Common App has like 10 activities and people feel pressured to fill out 10 activities. Like, I felt pressured to fill out 10 activities and I was like going through deep like research being like, what else can I put? Like,
so this is such a stupid nudge, but I've actually been working with some of the leaders at College Board to change this. Like, literally, I'm like, what if we just had two lines for extracurriculars? What if we just, and you could add them, you know, maybe there's like four clicks you had to do to add the button to do it, but the default is just much less, right? I think the problem is that we've turned the default into this extreme thing, this sort of academic arms race that like literally nobody could keep up with without sacrificing their mental health. And so I think, but the problem is, we know from arms races, you all aren't like political science majors, but you probably know, is like, you can't just have one university de-escalate, right? We have to do that kind of in collusion, right? Yeah. But I think more and more, these are ways where, you know, collective action on the part of undergraduates and maybe even collective action on the part of high school students could kind of help universities make the good choice that they should be making to deal with this. Like, if every high school student in the country did less, of course the best universities would change their standards, right? And so I do think there are things that we can do collectively and structurally to really fix the kind of weird situation we've gotten ourselves into. Mm-hmm.
This is different, but so you're on sabbatical right now, is that right?
So I'm technically not on sabbatical, I kind of did this thing where I sort of put all my teaching in the fall, and that's really travel and do talks and sort of focus on my podcast for the spring. So I'm not on campus a lot this spring, but I'm zooming into campus a lot this spring because I'm not actually on sabbatical.
Did you teach the psychology in the good life this fall?
I did not. I taught a new class, which I was really excited about. It was a seminar, right? Finally, a psych person since we're teaching this small seminar. It was on communicating psychology. So how do we share psychological findings, right? Whether that's in a podcast or in teaching, but more importantly on things like TikTok and Instagram, right? I think a lot of young people today are getting a lot of their psychological facts from these, you know, internet reels and TikTok videos. And that's pretty dangerous if those aren't evidence-based facts, or, you know, if they're not kind of things that really like map onto what's really going on in human psychology. And so with students, we really did a deep dive on like, you know, what's actually happening in these different platforms and how can we do better. It was a super fun class to teach.
Cool. Was there a reason like Psychology and the Good Life wasn't on the docket for the fall?
I think it was more just, I think the class is pretty resource intensive just in terms of teaching assistants and so on. And so the universities kind of had to balance how often we teach that just because it means that, you know, many of the grad students in psychology will have to TF that class versus another class. And so the DUS of Psych has been really awesome in terms of working with me to figure out like, okay, what's the best semester to teach it? How long of a break should we take? The plan is that it'll be taught again in January of 25. So a year from now is when I'll teach it again.
That's cool.
Our final semester. Crazy.
You can come back and sit in and remember what you learned, right?
Full circle.
Should we
That's
move
a good
to that
segue.
Then? Yeah, let's talk to that. Okay, I think the general overarching thing is like, so this is the only class Lula and I have taken together.
Yeah.
And we had different experiences, very different experiences. I think that we're excited to delve into some of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's mostly gonna be Jude and I arguing as a preface to listeners and to everyone. Yeah. Jude and I are very different students in general. And I think our interests are super different. And I think the way, like, this is kind of what I was trying to get at the beginning with what you were expecting going into Harvard, et cetera. I think we were positioned pretty differently mentally pre-Yale.
Yeah.
And so I think it was really interesting that we both took it our freshman spring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for context, we started the podcast sophomore fall.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of like circling back as we continued. Okay. Yeah. You want to start?
Okay. Okay. So I would say that I loved the class. I thought it was a very influential class. Now there were definitely things that like bothered me, frankly. And I'll say that, like, I think that like, but I don't think this is as much about the class. Like, I think this is just a general issue that I have with like social sciences. And like, it's like the limit of like what self-report measuring can look like. And that like, just like the measurements of, and like sometimes the statistical significance of studies, there's just like a general, like there are limitations to psychology studies. Which is just like, and as a cognitive neuroscience like person, I just am confronted with that often. But that I faced that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, one of the things I tried to get in front of in the class. I'm not sure from the student's perspective if that was obvious, but like, you know, because knowing that I'd have students from STEM majors and from the humanities, right? One of the things I tried to do was like, put the papers up there, right? Like mm-hmm. I always gave you, unlike some psych and some cog psych classes that just say, hey, here's how vision works XYZ. I was like, here's so-and-so's paper on how visions work. Mm-hmm. Read the paper, come up with your own conclusions, right? Like I was hoping students would come out critical of that. And so on the one hand, it's like a bummer. The student's like, oh, I'm so critical. I'm like, no, that's what I wanted you to do. I wanted you to ask the question, is this evidence good enough, right? So.
And I thought like the meta-analyses were like by far, like that was, I appreciated because there were a lot of meta-analyses throughout the course. And like when you collect all of these different studies to be able to prove one thing, it's like, okay, that's a much more, feels like a much more statistically significant finding.
Yep.
And I also really, really liked your psych trip, like psych tips. Like I reaped a ton of rewards from just simple things like hedonic adaptation, but also like little things that you would mention, like it makes more sense to spend money on experiences because you get to savor it and you get to like that memory lives on and it's the peak end rule where you remember the peak of it and the end of it. Like these things stuck with me really throughout for 3 years now.
Uh-huh. Nice, nice.
However, I will say I am a very habitual human being. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like that is one thing I have like
it's probably crazy.
Like compulsively. Okay. And we talk a lot about it. And one thing that I remember you saying, and correct me if I have this incorrect, but it was like around happiness is related around 50% to genetics, 10% to lifestyle, and like 40% to habits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one thing I'm curious.
I mean, it's not perfect. There's like, you know, you can't really be like some things for 50% genetics, but the point is like, it's a lot what you do that makes you happy.
Yeah. It has that what you do plays a big role in it.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, so I'm actually really curious to hear your experience also on this, because I took a lot of my findings throughout the semester. So like working out, meditation, not looking at grades. And I really just took it to the extreme and put it into my schedule and mm-hmm. my life. And so like, and I've been doing that now for 3 years. And I remember the first semester, it was so liberating. It felt so good. I felt so much happier. Like your class truly made me a happier human being. And 2 years later, and it may just simply be hedonic adaptation where I just got used to that happiness, mm-hmm. but like I still go on my runs, I'm still doing my gratitude journal, and like that pure, like, I feel the happiness has kind of dwindled. And I'm curious, like, maybe that's just hedonic adaptation, maybe that's something you experienced as well, maybe habits aren't all of it. Like, I'm just curious if you could speak on like that, because I think that was both frustrating and disheartening, but I'm also super scared of like not running, because what would it be if yep. my happiness if I stopped those practices?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's probably a little bit hedonic adaptation, right? And the fact that, remember, our brain notices changes, right? Like, if you weren't doing any of that stuff, if you weren't putting in habits to take care of yourself and you started, you're going to notice that change because, oh my gosh, you're probably feeling a lot happier from before you're taking the class to kind of during taking the class and afterwards, right? Mm-hmm. But there's no change from, like, you know, month one where you're exercising and doing all your self-care stuff to month two when you're exercising and doing all your self-care stuff. You just don't notice that transition. And so my guess is that, like, it's not so much that you're not as happy now, it's that you're not kind of reaping the benefit of that, like, sharp increase anymore. And that, you know, kind of is bad, right? I think it's one of the reasons that Yale students don't kind of take time to notice all the important opportunities they have and all the great things about Yale's, like, because you're just kind of, when you first get here, you're like, oh my God, dining hall, working out, all these different foods every day. There's a gym right down from my route. Like, you're so excited. But then months in, you kind of stop. So sounds like it's mostly hedonic adaptation. But I'm also hearing that it's not so much that you've gotten, like, unhappy from doing those things. It's just like you're not kind of continuing to skyrocket. And that might just be that you're, you know, at a ceiling effect for your own, like, you know, heritability of happiness, right? You mm-hmm. might be kind of like pushing the maximum with these habits of what, you know, you generally would be in terms of your happiness.
Is there any argument, when I think about hedonic adaptation, is there any argument to, like, stop those habits for a month or a week? Like, is there kind of playing with the mind of, like, when you get, like, kind of sporadic rewards in some case?
I mean, I think that for a lot of people that kind of happens naturally. Maybe you're, like, so hardcore with your habits, you never shift. But it gets busy and there's a period where you're not sleeping as much, or you kind of, like, the exercise kind of falls by the wayside a little bit. And you can have this moment, which I think, you know, we are having this conversation towards the end of the semester. I think this is a moment where people get back into it. It's like spring cleaning, end of the semester. All right, let me put these healthier habits back in. And you kind of start to notice it again. And so I think it's tricky. It's this interesting philosophical question of what you want to maximize. Do you want to, like, just have your happiness very high and at a steady rate? Or do you want to notice these changes over time? Mm-hmm. And the problem is, to notice the changes, you have to kind of backtrack a little bit. I think in class, I, like, mentioned that song by DJ Khaled, like, "All We Do Is Win." And I was like, that's a terrible way to live your life. Because if all you did is win, you just wouldn't notice any of, you'd have mm-hmm. to lose sometimes to notice how good the win feels. But, you know, do you want to be losing all the time? I think that's the question for you, is, like, do you want to remove those habits and feel kind of worse to kind of notice that change? I think you should just be at a kind of steady, decent happiness state, but but to each his own.
Yeah. Okay.
This is, like, reminding me of our therapy conversations. Can we ask, that's a weird question.
No, hit it. I don't know.
Do you think that the majority of Yalies would be helped by therapy?
Mm.
I think the majority of humans would be helped by therapy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it just gives you a period where you can ask tough questions and you could kind of reflect. I think that therapy is not the only way to do that. You can do that through journaling and other practices, but it's really helpful to have an appointment that's on your calendar with somebody who's skilled in this stuff, who can ask you those tough questions. So yeah, I think a lot of people would be helped by engaging in therapy or some sort of equally therapeutic kind of practice.
I agree. June and I are very therapized. Yeah. We just talk about it a lot. So
my mom's a psychoanalyst, so yeah, it's definitely ingrained in.
I'll throw it out there. Okay. Should I
hit your experience? Yeah.
Okay. I will say, on a similar note, I think, like, the most positive, similar note of, like, this was really helpful and then I lost the habit. My, like, version of experimenting on myself is that I was going to delete all my social media. And mm-hmm. it was so great. And I was so happy. And I don't even remember when I re-downloaded it. I want to say that it was probably some point in early summer. And I was probably, because we took the class in the spring. And I was probably like, I'm not going to have any form of contact with any of people if I'm not on social media. And I just wish it was easier to delete it again. Like, mm-hmm. I don't even know if I've deleted it since. Like, I definitely have the timer, like, the time limit thing on it. And I'm like, okay, I know this is bad for my brain, but I have such a like, I don't know. I feel like part of me knows that like if I delete it, I won't get it again, likely. Like it feels like such a conclusive decision. But I'm also like, then I do think there's like a real reality that is you are missing out on so much stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I'm so aware of all the bad stuff that comes with it. And I'm also like, this is really my main form of contact with so many people that I'm like, can't get myself to do it. I don't even have a question in there, but if you,
yeah, well, it sounds like you have some strategy. It sounds like, you know, you have those time limits on there, right? Like uh-huh. The key isn't necessarily to delete it forever. Although I think for some people who really struggle with it, the key might just be like, nope, I have to have full abstinence. Like it's kind of like never ever download it again. Uh-huh. But I think for a lot of people, it's not that. It's more just like noticing when it's making you feel kind of crummy, right? And having strategies for kind of getting off. One thing I've heard lots of students mention is sort of building in like stopping points, whether that's like setting a timer or like just kind of note, like have some stopping point, especially for things like TikTok where there's no built-in, like you could just kind of scroll forever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's good because then when the stopping point, you know, your timer goes off or something, you can say, am I feeling crummy or was that useful, right? And I think then you can kind of titrate it so you can figure out, okay, what's the appropriate amount of social media interaction so that I'm finding out the things I need to find out, like I'm having a little rest and relaxation, I'm getting the good parts out of it, but I don't like start to hit the crummy parts. I don't start to hit as much kind of social comparison or as much kind of gross time wasting in the case of TikTok, right? You can kind of titrate it so that you're getting the benefits with less of the drawbacks.
Yeah, I think TikTok. I want to be like, what are your thoughts on TikTok being banned? But Jude and I have talked about this so much. Yeah. I'm sure you have thoughts though.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like not super keen on like banning, but huh. I think like, finding, I mean, one of the things I worry about a lot on TikTok, especially after running this sort of communicating psychology class, where I kind of did a deep dive on like, okay, how does TikTok talk about mental health? And I was just like, oh my God, like it's all incorrect and like, mm-hmm. you know, actively kind of problematic and stuff. And so, you know, one thing I like to suggest is again, sort of having people ask the question, like, how are you feeling afterwards as a user, right? I think on the kind of creation side, I think we need more content creators that are kind of giving people evidence-based content on TikTok, like hopefully in a way that's like equally kind of entertaining and kind of fun and using the sort of usual TikTok things. And that was one of the most fun things about teaching this communicating psychology class was like, I had students who were making this stuff, like, you know, many mm-hmm. students for their like final project made a bunch of like evidence-based mental health TikToks. So like, here's how social comparison really works. Or like, here's like, you know, like ignore that stuff about narcissistic personality disorder, because that's wrong. But like, here's the thing that's correct about mental health that you really can do to protect your happiness. And so I think finding ways to flood those kind of channels with better, more evidence-based, more effective content is going to be really important. So there's a kind of fight fire with fire kind of attitude that I have towards TikTok too.
I think Jude and I share a lot of those sentiments. Should we talk about our differences in the class?
Yeah. Well, let's go through I think there's one big one.
Okay.
Grades.
Grades is our biggest thing. I was going to talk about...
What's yours?
Well, I was going to talk about how we came into the class differently.
You can do that one too. I don't care. You decide.
Okay. I'll go with the second one first, since we keep bringing it up.
Okay.
So I think I was faced like... I think that your class made me confront a lot of realities I did not want to face about Yale mm-hmm. that I did not have going in. And I think in the moment, like literally going to class, I would honestly be like frustrated leaving sometimes because I was like, I can't believe this is where I go to school. Like mm-hmm. just even the fact of like, I don't know, like sometimes you would use the example of like everyone's going to McKinsey and like this is what McKinsey does to you. Yeah. And I was so like, did not know that about Yale. Like, I just really don't know how to put it other than I came in blind mm-hmm. and to sit and be like, you're so unhappy here. This is why. Not that it wasn't true. Like, I was not like, this is inaccurate, but I was just like, I can't. It was really difficult in some ways to be faced with that freshman year mm-hmm. to be like, mm-hmm. I can't believe, like, did I not think things through correctly when I chose what college I was going to go to? Like all the other colleges I applied to for context were like music focused. Like they were almost conservatory type schools. And it was very like, Yale was a very different trajectory. And I was kind of like, I can't say no to Yale when I got in. And I'm still very glad I came here. And I honestly think your class has been more helpful now as a junior, looking back on, like, I had an understanding of, like, I kind of knew all of this was going to happen and I was going to feel this way. And yeah. I think during freshman year, it was so difficult to be like, every single person around me is like, thinks that $500,000 a year is going to make them the happiest ever. And like, I can't relate to them at all. And I don't know what I'm doing here. And I think also in retrospect, it helps me understand why you loved it so much in the moment, because I, not to speak for you, if you want to go, but I think you came in with more of a, like your sister went here and was like in kind of one of those like high business paths. And I feel like you had more exposure to people who were going to Ivies in general.
Well, I just like my freshman year, like my freshman fall sucked. Like I was like studying for hours in the library and I was like, wait. But I thought that once I went to Yale, I could like explore and like be different and not care about grades. Grades don't matter. What am I like? I didn't get it. But then I was sucked right back in. And then I have this teacher, this professor who's like, wait, no, like stop looking at grades. And I was like, okay, like sure. Like if you tell me to, I
I'm
will.
Really proud to hear that you just like don't look at grades anymore. This makes me incredibly happy.
They make it really hard here. I don't like, every grade is like thrown in my face. Like every time I open Canvas, I have to like barely open my eyes and like scan to the, but yeah. So
Your
I think that's,
very
I already had like a down bad like experience, and then I just was kind of, I think that class like reaffirmed it, but then was like, try these things and see if it worked, and then they worked in that semester, and I was like, oh wait, awesome, like I'll cling on to these for dear life.
I mean, I think it raises this question of like, who's the class best for? I think that's another challenge of the class, right, is that I have first years who are like, you know, dealing with coming from all kinds of different perspectives when they're kind of navigating Yale and don't know some of its downsides as well as say upper class students. But then at the same time, I had second semester seniors, right, who would like, you know, it's kind of at that point like a little too late for them to kind of change their way they're dealing with Yale, but they're kind of thinking about using these strategies in the future, and then kind of students all in between. And so it's tricky to kind of figure out like what that baseline needs to look at. I mean, one of the things I've talked about with the department is like, should it just be a first year class, right? And I can kind of set it up like, hey, I'm going to educate you about what Yale looks like. This is going to be a little shock and awe. Some of you might be really mad about it, but then now you have some agency of how to fix it, versus like, it's just a class for say juniors, assuming that everybody knows what Yale is. And many people are kind of deep in the trenches of some of the maybe not so good habits of a place like this. And so, yeah, so it's a challenge that we tried to figure out. I mean, everyone was going to be mad if we like capped it and said, oh, first years can't get in.
Yeah.
First years would have been mad, you know, so there was no way to win on that one, unfortunately, but yeah.
That's super interesting, considering if it was like a first year, not a like seminar, but like for first years.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like a introduction. I don't like, in a way, it kind of got the bad stuff out of the way. Like it wasn't like a secret. Like I was like, oh, this is who I'm surrounded by. I get like, I'm a little upset at my environment, but I can like, it'll make things make sense later on. Okay, so grades.
Grades. This one we really differ here.
We're super unresolved on this. And my feelings about it are more of like an institute, like a Yale thing than a class specific thing. Mm-hmm. But should we give like context for non-Yale-y listeners? Credit D, I think we should talk about that, right?
Briefly. Before it
is like Yale's basically take pass fail option. And you have six chances in your undergrad career to take, right? Is it six? To take classes, credit D, and two of those expire in your freshman year. Okay, your class is the only class I've ever taken pass fail.
I'm so proud of you. Thank you for listening to me and taking a credit D. Yeah.
Okay, before we get into it, I want to ask why, for the listener, hear your explanation of why to take it pass fail.
Yeah, because like study after study shows that when you're taking something for a grade, you learn less of the content, you enjoy it less. The thing that you're doing for a grade increases your negative emotion and decreases your positive emotion, right? Like it's also, there's also evidence that students who take things for a grade are more prone to cheat and like kind of cut corners, sometimes in problematic ethical ways, right? Like none of the stuff I wanted for my class, right? Like I want people to have more positive emotion and really learn these strategies and remember them over time. And so I encourage students to take, I wanted Yale to set the class up so that it had to be credit D. Like, does everybody had to do it credit D? Yet there's no mechanism at Yale to do that. I wish there was. And so I just like spent a bunch of time kind of telling you all the evidence of why you should take it credit D. But it's so nice to hear that you actually listened to me and did that, because not a lot of students did. But yeah.
I definitely did. I'm glad I did. I think my, and this goes back to the Yale level, my frustrations with it is like, there's only, why are there only six chances to take a class credit D?
Agreed. 100,000%. Yeah.
And it gets so specific, because there was a moment where I was like, I don't know if I should take this credit D, because what if I'm like really struggling in a later semester where I'm taking overloaded on credits and I need to take multiple things credit D to pass. And I wish those factors weren't there. And I also think it did make, I think off of what you just said, it definitely made me like think about the class detached from my grades, which was very helpful. And then I think in some ways, taking a class credit D makes it very hard for me to like feel focused when it comes to like exam time. Like when it comes to like reviewing and like, I'm going to walk into the class and I'm going to sit down for a couple hours and take this test. I'm like, what am I doing here? Like I should be practicing happiness. And you've talked about this in your class. Like there's no real way to get around an assessment at Yale. Like Yale, right? Yeah. They would kind of be like, what's the class then?
I mean, you saw what we did for our assessment, right? Where it's like, you know, the big final exam, we gave you like almost like a final, like, you know, do this little experiment on yourself. Yes. Half of it was really just like something you do in advance. So it shouldn't be as scary, right? Yeah. That was the best kind of Yale would let me do in terms mm-hmm. of like easing these sort of assessments. But again, it doesn't have to be that way. You know, there are whole universities where, for example, first year or even beyond are just like no grades, right? Like,
mm-hmm. yeah.
So in some ways we don't need that, right? Or you could have a grade, but everybody's grade is going to be an A if you keep putting time in. Right. Say you turn mm-hmm. that final exam in and I'm like, oh, you didn't understand. You didn't explain the methods well, or like you kind of missed something about hedonic adaptation. Do it over and you'll like the expectation is what I want you to do is to get it and then you'll get a good grade. Right. And we could have those policies. We just don't.
But they don't let you. Yeah. Because like I think a big thing that people were like is like, oh, my God, like I'm going to take this class. And if I don't pass fail it, I'm going to get a C. And then like. And I don't know why
everybody thought I was going to get C's. I know. That was crazy. It's like no one at Yale gets C's. Like, that was like, what do we know? Like 0.5% of people at Yale get like C's. Like, it just doesn't happen. Like, yeah.
I think that was like a fizz.
It was a fizz. It was a fizz moment.
Yeah, it was a fizz moment. Yeah.
Okay, I have like two other just general questions just for you. One is just like for our listeners, just, I mean, a lot of us has been talking about the class and like what we liked and what we struggled with and what I'm grappling with even today. I'm just generally like, for people that have or have not taken your class, for everyone, like what are like some general like practical tips of you being like, hey, like a dinner party conversation, what do you say when you say, hey, how can I increase my happiness?
Yeah, well, I usually start by explaining that we have these misconceptions when it comes to happiness, right? We mentioned grades, we mentioned money and these kinds of things. Like there are all these things we assume are going to matter for our happiness, but don't. And so we kind of have to overcome those misconceptions if we want to kind of focus on the real stuff that's going to matter for happiness. Then you ask, okay, well, what really does matter for happiness? And we see first, it's our behaviors. So things like engaging in social connection, doing nice things for other people, just making sure you have some free time, getting sleep and exercise, right? Those kinds of healthy habits and healthy behaviors matter. Then there's all these things that we can do to change our mindset when it comes to happiness. And so this is sort of developing practices of things like gratitude, of being more present, talking to yourself in a better, more self-compassionate way, right? Something I think Yale students really, really need some help mm-hmm. with, right? All of these things sort of matter a lot for happiness. And I think the key to those behavioral and mindset shifts are really recognizing that like you have agency, right? Like you actually have some individual agency over your happiness. That doesn't mean there aren't all these structural changes we need to make. You know, we just talked about a bunch of them of like changing college admissions, you know, changing a lot of the policies at Yale and so on. But like, there are also things we can do at the individual level to kind of help with happiness. And I think there's a real synergy there. I think if we look at the kind of collective action that students need to be taking to get more mental health resources, to kind of fight to make the place that is Yale a mentally healthier place on like for students to be and for students to learn, I think it's easier for them to fight for those collective changes while they're also doing stuff to take care of their mental health, right? You know, you just don't see student activists like doing as much activism if they're super worried about their grade and like stuck in the library trying to study for some test, right? You just don't see students engaged in anything that's like big picture when you're so caught up and so stressed and you're just triaging everything, right? And so I think the cool thing about these mindset and behavioral changes is like there are things we can do to take agency in these like little hacky ways to feel better. And once we start feeling better, we can make all kinds of changes to our university, to our performance, and so on.
I have like a related question in terms of a big picture discussions of happiness. Not really happiness, actually. It's kind of complicated nuance, but Jude and I have talked about this on the podcast before. Like, it feels sometimes unhelpful that there's so much that's like how to live a good life. Like, not trying to say that that's what you just did at all. I just mean on a separate note, like distinguishing, like these are actual like studied misconceptions about happiness versus these like kind of crazy culty like self-help books and movements.
And what Jude follows. Yeah.
Did I word that correctly? Yeah. I'm like, yeah. It's kind of hard to talk
I
about.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. Because yeah. I feel like there's a crucial difference. Yeah,
the
there.
Problem is like a lot of those, some of the self-help movements are fine. Like they're picking up on things that we know are evidence-based changes that if we ran a randomized controlled trial or looked at meta-analyses, it'd be fine, right? Take something like writing in a gratitude journal. I think that can feel a little culty when you look at gratitude apps and stuff, but like there's good evidence there that if you do that, that's pretty good. But there's also all these like self-helpy type strategies that are just as popular and just as common and just as culty that are just wrong when it comes to the evidence, right? Like my favorite one that I hear about all the time is this idea of like manifesting. Like, oh, I'm just going to think these positive thoughts and I'm going to manifest, right? If you remember the class, we looked at studies that looked at this, like how much do you imagine your positive futures? And what the studies find is that it's the opposite. The more you imagine like, oh, I'm just going to get great grades, the less you're motivated to do anything, right?
You this just is answered by such a big question of the podcast. We love that.
We've talked about this on like four
this
different
episodes. This is awesome. Okay, so wait.
No, it's like, so I'm like, oh my God, it's not just that manifesting is neutral or it doesn't work. It's an
bad.
Actively bad strategy when it comes to yourself. And so this is one of the reasons I get so frustrated is like, I think some of these self-help strategies are useful, but they're kind of all lumped together and no one's talking about like, where does the evidence come from? And mindful, like, you know, we can critique the evidence that we do have for some of these things, right? And I'm happy, like Jude, that you actually brought that up, but like, for some of these things, we like, there's no evidence, or like the evidence that we have is the opposite, right? And so I think we really need to push back on some of it. So I hate these self-help strategies in part because like often everything gets packaged together. You know, I'll get books to review for the podcast where it's like, you know, good strategy number one, like be self-compassionate and talk to yourself in like a healthier, more compassionate way. Okay, tick, that's good. And also manifest. I'm like, no, those don't go together. They're like totally different. So.
Okay, one more question on the manifesting.
Okay.
I understand that it's not helpful.
So there's a good way and a bad way to manifest. Maybe that's okay.
I think broke her brain.
Sorry. The positive way to manifest is you, and this is, again, work by Gabrielle Oettingen. She has a wonderful book called Rethinking Positive Thinking that goes through all this evidence. Recommend it to everybody who's interested in manifesting. But the idea is you think about the positive future. Like, I want to get a really good grade in the seminar. What would happen if I got a good grade in the seminar? It would be so cool. Like I'd, you know, be able to apply to these fellowships and I'd feel really proud of myself or whatever. But the problem is you don't stop there. You ask, okay, what's holding me back like from getting a good grade, right? And so Gabrielle Oettingen talks about your wish, which is like, oh my God, I wish I get a good grade, what the outcome would be, right? And that's kind of the manifesting part. Oh, it'd be so great. But then you don't end there. The next steps are obstacle. Okay, what's preventing me from getting a good grade? Like, oh, like I don't study here. Like I have all this stuff coming up. Like, you know, I'm going to go to spring fling. I'm not going to, it's like, okay, what's a plan? This is her WHOOP method. So wish, outcome, obstacle, plan. How can I overcome that obstacle, right? So the problem is when you manifest and you just stop at the manifesting, if you use the manifesting, be like, this would be so good. Okay, what do I actually need to do to put this into effect? And then you make a plan. Now it's great. Now you've kind of had the fantasy, but you know what the fantasy connects to. So it's not even so much that the manifesting is bad. It's just the manifesting without the kind of next step of asking yourself, okay, good, hard look. Why am I not doing that? Right. And then when you look at that, you can kind of make a plan that helps.
Okay. I'm calm now.
Thank God.
Thank you. That helped me. Okay.
One last question is just, what has been the most helpful practice for your happiness that you've taken? On.
Oh my gosh. So easy. It's focusing on time affluence, that sense that you have some free time. You know, as we talked about when we were trying to schedule this, I'm incredibly busy. I have this podcast. I have like classes on campus. I have my research. I have talks that I give. I could just be chronically overloaded all the time if I'm not really careful. And so I constantly have to protect my time affluence. And it's hard. It's super, super hard. It means I turn down all kinds of fun opportunities and I'm on campus less than I want to be and so on. But it's been so helpful. Yeah. So for me, the biggest happiness challenge that I face is time. And I have to work on it with a lot of intention all the time.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us.
Totally. Yeah, it wasn't meant to like guilt check you.
No.
You should see this as a good high bar to kind of come on show for my students.
Well, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also, will you give a shout out? So please shout out podcast, The Happiness Lab with Pushkin Industries. What else do you want to shout out?
I think for folks who are taking this, especially folks who aren't at Yale and don't have the opportunity to take my class here, to check out the online version of the happiness class. So like if this looked intriguing, check out the Science of Wellbeing. And we have a new class, the Science of Wellbeing for Teens, which if you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking about college and stuff in the future, it's a class like really specifically for high school students with the idea that we can kind of get this content to people before they wind up in the college application cycle. And can try to figure out some strategies that'll help them there too.
Go take that, because honestly, I needed it, you all. I really needed it. So, Professor Santos, thank you so much for joining us.
Well,
it was
so
a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And
yeah.
Thank you for making me not look at my grades. That's probably the most influential
I'm
thing
so
you've done.
I'm
so
proud. I you know, you put this stuff out there, but I'm like, if someone asks me, is it really true that there's at least a single student who after your class stopped looking at his grades? Now
I'm
you
here.
Know. Yes,
link them
yes,
to the podcast.
2 years later.
It's crazy. Well, with that, thank you all so much for listening. We will see you next Sunday.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.